Major fighting here.
It's all over the place. Holy f***.
Abnormal.
I see dead people walking around like regular people.
Paranormal. Somewhere between abnormal and paranormal.
I felt like something was near me. Kind of a eerie feeling.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
Jeremy Scott asks the questions that we're all dying to know.
You can't handle the truth!
Hello? Hello?
You can't keep him down, no matter how hard you try.
Hey, that's the guy!
Traveling into the witching hour from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, you're riding into the paranormal.
Yeah, that dungeon going from hot as blazes to cooling right around this time of the year, and it is very remote here on this Labor Day weekend. It's my privilege to have you along. It's going to be a program tonight that will be one you will want to hear from beginning to end. As we hear from Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute, the big guns, the ones looking for extraterrestrial life. Actually, a lot of news on that front tonight as well before we get to Mr. Seth Shostak, senior astronomer from SETI. And late last year, the six astronauts on the moon, the Apollo 14 mission. We're talking, of course, about Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the late great, who founded the FREE organization, Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters, experiencer.org. And Ray Hernandez is going to be here tonight, as we're going to look back on the life of Dr. Edgar Mitchell, a life that many people aren't even aware of. So it should be some enlightening stuff here tonight. You know, speaking of SETI and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and the efforts of Seth Shostak and others, since we spoke last on the program, there's been some news that turns out not to really be much on the extraterrestrial front, but more terrestrial. Much like the WOW signal of decades past and the report of an alleged alien megastructure last year, now we get reports of something that happened in May of last year. But reports just emerging that a team of Russian astronomers with a telescope spotted a signal that came from a star about 95 light years from Earth. Now again, this sparks all sorts of controversy and conspiracy about whether or not this is an alien signal. And it very well could be. Seth's organization, for the last 30 or so years, has been looking for any signs of extraterrestrial life. And they looked for two nights with their telescopes and couldn't find any sign of this signal that was found by the Russians. In fact, Seth has some comments that will precede our conversation with him tonight.
We've been looking for this signal using the Allen Telescope Array. We spent two nights looking for it. We couldn't find it. So what was it? Could it have been ET and then for some reason they went off the air? Or could it have been terrestrial interference? You know, something like a telecommunications satellite or a radar on an aircraft. Well, we still don't know. We couldn't find the signal. And now the Russian Academy of Sciences is saying it was a military satellite. So no detection yet. But look, you know, you can't always be cynical. If a signal is looking promising, we are going to check it out.
Could it be that the Allen Telescope Array is flawed? That maybe they're looking in all the wrong places, as I've said before. You know, SETI shows that they're only going to put 2 days or two nights of effort into this latest signal. It could have been if they were there the night before or the night after. They may have found what they were looking for. But in this case, two nights, no sign, they move on. In other cases, they look for a whole lot longer than that. But they point their telescopes at certain frequencies and not at others. Well, what's to say that aliens, extraterrestrials, communicate at all on a frequency, let alone that frequency in which they're looking? Talk about needle in a hair, in a haystack. So it might be that the ATA, the Allen Telescope Array, could be flawed. Because I would hate to think that the folks who are behind that organization, despite looking and looking and looking some more, still can't find the evidence to what you and I pretty much know. That they have been here, that they are here, that they're going to be here. Perhaps it was extraterrestrials who were behind this signal and departed. Very well could be. Could it be terrestrial interference? Take out the extra out of the conversation. Just plain old terrestrial interference. You know, there was the story that I brought you last week on the program about a weird, very weird technology block in Illinois. I mean, it affected emergency calls, it affected cell phones, and on and on and on. Everything that you could imagine couldn't get a signal out. Yeah, couldn't get a signal out. So we've got this terrestrial interference. We've got a technology block. Is there something going on? Is there something a-brewing? Is this a test for something that's going to be used on us? Maybe we shouldn't be worried about terrorism. Maybe we shouldn't even be worried about nuclear war, as we discussed last week with Tom Pettit. Maybe we should be worried about the ETs. Or maybe this is something that has just come from within, a clandestine government, a organization that is behind a screen and behind another curtain. If you believe it or not, you would have to maybe agree that all these things are a little bit suspicious, coincidental or not. And Seth also says that if they get reports of something like this, and it looks promising, they are going to check it out. As I think they should, I just think that they should probably spend a little bit more time doing so. Well, did you know that since we last talked on this program, and in fact, even as I was bringing you my Sunday special last week, we came this close to an asteroid wiping us out, or an asteroid came that close to us. Actually, space.com calls it a close shave, and I like that. So astronomers first spot this object on Saturday, and on Sunday, it bypasses Earth within 50,000 miles of the planet. Now, 50,000 miles may seem like a very, very long distance to you, and it is. Consider we are about 239,000 miles from the moon. 50,000 miles is a very close distance when you consider it, although it kind of is just over there, not in our peripheral. Certainly wasn't in the peripheral of even astronomers, because they didn't even notice the thing until a day before. But I'm sure that if this thing came any closer to you and I, we'd probably want to know about it. Good luck, though. This thing was anywhere between 80 and 180 feet wide. That's right, slightly bigger than what exploded over a Russian city in 2013, which injured 1,200 people on the ground. As I've said before, and I will say again, there are tens of thousands of these potentially dangerous asteroids that are just out there buzzing around all the time that supposedly these astronomers have their eyes on. Yet something comes this close to us, and we have almost no notice further making my point that I do not believe if anything like this is going to happen to us, that we are going to get any sort of notice. I don't believe in doomsday. I don't believe in any of those end-of-the-world scenarios. I just don't. It's going to happen without notice. We're not going to be told about it prior. And they're certainly not going to come to us after and give us a survey or anything like that either. Out of the Santa Monica Observer, there's a story with a little bit of speculation and conspiracy tied to it about a Southwest Airlines plane that made an emergency landing last weekend. Apparently was a major blowout of one of its two engines. And if that sounds doomsday-ish to you, you're right. I still have no clue why a plane can lose one of its engines mid-flight and still complete the mission. Why wasn't there extensive damage, this story asks? Why didn't this plane crash? And that is a very, very good question. Now, the plane was diverted to Pensacola, Florida. Could this have been some alien intervention? I don't know. Paranormal experts are saying it was a UFO encounter that may have caused the engine to blow out, but why the plane wasn't doomed, I guess we'll never know. And here's a story for you to laugh your Saturday night away with. Apparently, ghosts can be stolen. I don't know if you can actually file a police report of such, or if they would investigate. But this story from Greater Manchester, the owner of a haunted pub, says a Chinese artist came to the pub and bottled up this famous ghost and took it. Apparently it's been quite a spectacle, drawing people from all around the area, certainly maybe even the world. And now the owner wants the ghost back somewhere, some place. Somebody's got the title Ghost Police. And they just might come after you. Producer Bella on cue tonight, queuing up Genie in a Bottle. I don't know that I ever endorse Christina Aguilera or if you will ever hear it again, but we couldn't resist that temptation. We're breaking her in slowly and surely. She's running the controls for the program tonight. So if anything's screwed up, blame her. I am in an undisclosed location somewhere in the Midwest of the United States. Headed down to Texas, in fact. Got some business to take care of there. But for tonight, I've picked out many prime pickings. We've got Seth Shostak, the guy you heard from just a moment ago, in an interview that I did not too very long ago, actually. If you're new to this program, you'll find this conversation fresh tonight. Let's learn about the senior astronomer from SETI, Mr. Seth Shostak.
SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, of the private nonprofit organization which is dedicated to scientific research, education, and public outreach, that was funded in 1984. The heads of the International Academy of Astronautics SETI Permanent Study Group as well. Shostak first developed an interest in extraterrestrial life at the tender age of 10 when he picked up a book about the solar system. That eventually led him to study for a degree in radio astronomy. He has a particular interest in science in general and astrobiology in particular. He has co-authored a college textbook on astrobiology, written trade books, and Confessions of an Alien Hunter, a Scientist's Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, back in 2009, but it is still very relevant today. In fact, it may be more relevant than ever. Good evening, Seth.
Good evening to you, Jeremy.
Joining us from somewhere in, I'm guessing, sunny California?
Well, it's not sunny at the moment, but it is California, and it's normally sunny. This is actually the Silicon Valley, so we're just south of San Francisco.
Beautiful part of the country, isn't it?
Well, it is, except for all the hominids that are driving around here. But, yeah, it's nice.
I had a couple of stories. I'm not sure if you had a chance to catch them in the early part of the program, but I'll catch you up on a couple of these headlines that no doubt you probably have had your mind on. One of them is actually right from your organization, which talked about these 20,000 star systems that had previously not really been identifiable as worthy of, I guess, your time in searching for intelligent life. What's the latest with that?
Yeah, that's our Red Dwarf survey. Now, Red Dwarf, well, anybody listening in Britain will probably think that's a television show, but actually Red Dwarf refers to a small kind of star, a star a little bit smaller than the sun, maybe 50%, 70%, 80% the diameter of the sun. But when you make a star a little bit smaller than the sun, they get a lot dimmer than the sun. So these guys are very dim. They have relatively low temperatures, and that's why they're called red dwarfs, because they look a little bit red. Anyhow, there are a lot of them. Three quarters of all stars are these small guys. And in general, we never looked at them before, but we have good reason now, I think, to start looking at them. In the last 5 years, we've learned something about these guys that suggests they may be the place where E.T. is hanging out. So we're going to look at 20,000 of them over the next 2 years.
Fantastic. What are the prospects?
Well, who knows? I mean, nobody knows. You know, when it comes to SETI, the usual assumption is that if you want to find E.T., you use these big antennas, you point them in the direction of nearby star systems, hoping they have a planet with somebody clever on it. And the question is, well, should you just look at a relatively small number of stars but cover as much of the radio dial as you can, because after all, you don't know where the signal is going to be? Or is it better to say, look, can't cover all the dial, but I'll look at a lot of stars? And nobody knows which is the better strategy, but we've usually used the former. We've usually looked at small numbers of stars. When I say small, you know, you could spend years looking at 1,000 stars. Over a wide range of the radio dial. But now we're going to try something different, not cover the complete radio dial, but look at 20,000 of these things and a different kind of star system, a red dwarf.
Why does our solar system fascinate you, Seth?
Our solar system, well, I think that dates back to when I was a kid, and I pulled an atlas off the shelf in my parents' home, and there was a diagram in the back which had a bunch of circles on it, and I asked my mom, now, what are those things? And she said planets, which was a word I hadn't heard before. And she explained a little bit about them. And then, you know, I went to the museums. I went to the planetariums that I happened to be able to go to. And it just seemed all very interesting, the idea that the Earth was just a small speck in a much more interesting environment. You know, by age 10, I'd built a telescope and all that sort of thing. So, you know, astronomy is a science. It's a subject that fascinates a lot of people.
It's certainly fascinating to go down that road tonight with you, Seth, as well. We have a couple of other headlines that I'd like to get your thoughts on before we really delve into how you got started with SETI and what the organization is doing at this point in time. Two headlines that I don't know, they don't anger me, but they frustrate me because they both use the word alien in the headline. One says, new alien planet boasts rare triple suns. The other headline says, alien Earth may be forming around the nearby star. These were headlines yesterday and the day previous, both from space.com. If they were alien planets, if they were alien Earth, don't you think SETI would know about it? Are they using that that name a little bit too loosely over there at space.com?
Well, I think they're trying to get your attention. And, Jeremy, they got your attention, didn't they? By using the word alien. Alien is kind of a loaded word. Actually, when I first came to the SETI Institute, at that point, SETI was still a NASA project, actually, very early 1990s. The boss, who was a NASA guy, said, don't ever use the word alien. He said, because that's somewhat ambiguous and it has negative connotations. Always use the word extraterrestrial. Well, you know, he didn't write articles or talk to people. I mean, if you do either one, you get really tired of saying extraterrestrial or writing it all the time. So alien was a good shortcut. And after all, come on, it just comes from the Latin. It just means other. So an alien planet is just somebody else's planet, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And have you heard about the story about using this laser defense system to, quote, conceal the Earth from the evil aliens?
Yeah, I think those are a couple of guys at Columbia University, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, correct.
I'm frequently mistaken, so maybe I am here.
No, but you got that right.
Oh, did I get that right? Okay, good. Well, these guys said, look, you know, one thing that makes the Earth visible, at least to, if you will, 2% of the universe, that happens to be located in the right position, to once every 365 days see the fact that see the sun dim by one part in 10,000 because the Earth is passing in front of it, right? It's kind of a mini eclipse, if you will, from their point of view. They don't see the little dot moving across the sun. Of course, that would require, you know, the mother of all telescopes, but they could easily see the fact that the sun for a couple of hours gets 0.01% dimmer. So that would betray the presence of our planet. And by the way, it would also tell them how big our planet is. And by seeing that it happens every 365 days, that would tell us how far from the sun we are and stuff like that. So they would get a clue that, hey, there's a planet that could have life. And there are people who think that that might be dangerous information to share. I'm not among them, by the way, but there are people who think that. And so this the scheme from these guys at Columbia was to use some big lasers to fill in that missing light from the sun so they don't see the dip in brightness of our home star.
Now, if you were an astronaut, Seth, and you were up in space, maybe as long as Scott Kelly, close to a year, and you were on, maybe one of these other astronauts from these other countries that have gone up to the International Space Station, and you were up there long enough, and there were aliens and UFOs around, don't you think you would see one? And Tim Peake has said he did see an alien craft, and Scott Kelly has hinted that he saw aliens. What do you make of those statements?
Well, that's witness testimony. I don't know why the aliens would, you know, make themselves so easily visible to these guys who are, after all, only 200 miles from the surface of the Earth, and yet we can't see it from the ground, right? I mean, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I've spoken with a lot of the astronauts, actually, including people, you know, like Edgar Mitchell and Story Musgrave and so forth and so on, mostly, you know, the Apollo astronauts. And several of them have made claims about seeing aliens. But, you know, witness testimony, it isn't very good in science. Isaac Newton didn't say, well, you know what? I think that force equals mass times acceleration. You know, you had to have an experiment to prove that. And he was able to prove it by looking at the planets. And, you know, just because somebody says something, unfortunately, in science, it doesn't mean much. In fact, probably doesn't mean much any other time either.
Our conversation will have to end there for now. But when we come back, more with the senior astronomer from SETI, Seth Shostak.
Into the paranormal.
Hey, you can now listen to the program for free on your phone. That's right. There's two ways to do that. If you go to intotheparanormal.wix.com/ITP radio, you'll find the numbers to call. And they're very simple, 641-793-7154. And also 515-605-9553. We have two of those because sometimes they'll get filled up. And both of those numbers are on the website. Of course, we're on the Radionomy app. We're on TuneIn, Spreaker, YouTube, sometimes, when they don't flag us for having licensed music. Valentine Radio in Valentine, Texas, 1610 AM. And in Hillsboro, Ohio, on 106.9 FM. As our conversation continues with the senior astronomer from SETI, Seth Shostak.
Seth, talk about being 10 years old, picking up this book on the solar system, and then wanting to know what was beyond that.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that I even wondered that. I just thought, well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, there are other worlds. I mean, you know, when you're a kid, the idea of planets is a little unusual if you haven't spent a lot of time outside and noticed that some of the brighter stars or what look like stars actually move around from night to night or week to week or month to month. I mean, I hadn't made that connection. And yet here somebody was telling me, yeah, they're actual worlds. And then you get it out of book and you see, hey, here are pictures of these things made with telescopes. And, you know, one of them has rings around it and another one is red and it looks kind of odd and whatever, that kind of thing. I mean, who wouldn't be interested in other worlds? It's hard to imagine too many people who have no interest in their own environment, who don't want to know how they fit in some sense, in terms of the cosmic scheme of things. I mean, there's a lot of survival value in knowing your environs. And so I'm sure that we were interested in such things even 100,000 years ago. It's probably what allows us to make good maps Better maps than I noticed the dolphins making, for example.
So, Seth, you have this fascination as a young kid, probably kept through you with school, with your schooling in high school and whatnot, and you were probably, I'm guessing, one of the people who always wanted to be first for any sort of science experiment. Am I right about that?
Well, not always. I was never very good at chemistry, although chemistry offered the possibility of building or of of doing something that might blow up. I mean, it had that.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's kind of cool, but I never quite understood chemistry. There was too much memorization. I like physics, and I like mathematics, and I like biology, actually. I actually won some scholarships in biology. My mom was hoping I'd go to school and study biology.
So you held this interest in science and astrobiology, and then you decided to do what with it?
Well, I didn't decide much of all, actually. I went to college. I studied physics. My father suggested I do that, and I did do that. And then I went to grad school. And in grad school, I was accepted by the physics department there. But I was there a couple of weeks, and physics sounded more and more esoteric and kind of dull. But astronomy, that sounded really pretty interesting. And, of course, I had the interest in astronomy. So when I got to grad school, I applied to the astronomy department. And they said, well, if you were accepted by the physics department, we'll accept you, too. So they did. And I went into radio astronomy because I was also interested in electronics. So that seemed sort of neat.
What is radio astronomy?
Well, radio astronomy is just like ordinary astronomy. I mean, most people think of astronomy. They have this interesting idea that the astronomers, put on a jacket and they hike up a mountain. They go into a dome. The telescope is, racked forward so that it sticks through the dome, something that never happens, of course. And then they look at the moon or maybe Mars or something, maybe take a few notes. And then, when their clipboard is filled with notes, they shut the whole thing down and go home. Obviously, that's not what happens. Astronomers don't do that. But they do use telescopes that usually have mirrors and lenses. Those are the classic kinds of telescopes. Today, we're very good at building them, by the way. They're incredible telescopes being built these days with mirrors, not so much with lenses, but with mirrors. But radio astronomy doesn't use that kind of technology. Radio astronomy uses big antennas. They kind of look like your backyard satellite dish on steroids. Really scale up. Some of them are enormous. The one in Puerto Rico is 1,000 feet across. That's a pretty big hunk of metal there. And you point these things at the sky and have a sensitive receiver at the back. And now you see the cosmos's natural radio static. You might think, well, that's not very interesting to listen to. And it's not. But if you measure it, it turns out it tells you all sorts of nifty stuff.
Did you ever think, Seth Shostak with the SETI Institute, my guest here in this hour, did you ever think that you would be making a living looking through telescopes? That's pretty cool.
Well, it is, although we could discuss how much of a living it is. This is not the most lucrative profession in the Silicon Valley, that I have to say, but it is certainly amongst the most interesting, and at least we address a big question. That's something I really do like. I mean, the telescopes are the instruments, but the idea that you're trying to answer a question that, in a sense, probably every Homo sapiens is asked at least once. They walk out at night, they look up, and they say, well, I wonder if anybody's up there looking this way, right? So finally, here at the beginning of the 21st century, we have technology that could, at least in principle, answer that question. So, it's kind of a privilege to be able to do that. That's true.
So how did you get involved with the SETI Institute? Did you help start the organization?
No, I didn't. In 1984, when the SETI Institute was started, I was living in Europe. I was living in Holland. I was working at a university studying galaxies. But I was certainly interested in, SETI. I'd read about Frank Drake's experiments in 1960 and subsequent ones. And I knew some of the people. I would meet them at conferences. And some of them actually came to town, came to our university. So I knew some of the people. And I would give talks about it just for the heck of it, to the public mostly. When I moved to California in 1988, I was doing something else here for about a year and a half. But then some of the people at the SETI Institute actually saw me at a party over in Berkeley.
Uh-oh.
And they called me up the next week and they said, hey, we're hiring. You want a job here? And as it turned out, I did. So here I am.
And no turning back.
Well, I don't know. If it's possible to turn the clock back, I'd go for that. As far as career choice, I got to say, no regrets. We haven't found anything yet. But on the other hand, the chances keep getting better. And besides that, all along the way, you're solving interesting puzzles and, you're learning stuff every day here. So that's good.
And this is a full-time job.
It is. It's a full-time job. It's more than a full-time job, actually. It is.
Double time.
I have yet to have a weekend free for the last couple of months.
Double time.
It is.
You're actually going to depart to a conference tomorrow.
Yeah, there is the Contact Conference. It's actually running on right now as I speak to you, and I have to give a talk there tomorrow morning, so I have to prepare that. The Contact is a conference that brings together sci-fi writers and aficionados, of course, but also scientists, NASA scientists, obviously on there, so the SETI scientists. And, you know, we talk about whatever we want to talk about, but it's often about, you know, what happens if you actually meet the extraterrestrials, or how are we looking, or things like that. And it runs for 3 days. Unfortunately, you know, since I'm done with my talk at the conference, I have to pretty much immediately go back and pack and go to the Conference on World Affairs in Boulder, Colorado, and that's where I'll be for a week.
Do you really have to prepare for things, Seth? I mean, you're a really smart guy. It seems like, you know, you could just sit up there and talk for hours.
Well, I probably could do that. I think that they would have a big white hook and pull me off the stage pretty quickly. To be quite candid, Jeremy, it depends. If it's an audience that has never heard me before and they just want to learn something about SETI, then I can give an, if you will, off-the-shelf talk without too much preparation. But, you know, this Contact Conference, I mean, they've heard me before. I can't just go in there and say, well, this is how we're looking for ET. I have to give them something new. And I chose a very exotic title for the talk back a year ago before I thought that I was going to have to prepare it the night before I gave the talk.
Can you share that with us?
Yeah. It's SETI looks for life. No, wait a minute. SETI looks for intelligence that isn't alive.
So do you believe that the aliens were alive and they're dead now?
Well, there probably are some, but that isn't the actual motivation for that title. The motivation is this. In this century, one of the most important things, well, certainly the most important thing we're likely to do is invent our successors, which is to say invent machine intelligence. I mean, you know, we don't have intelligent machines now. Well, they can play a pretty good game of chess or Go or Jeopardy, but, you know, they don't think, they don't replace a white-collar job, really. But, you know, as compute power continues to increase, that will change. And so I think it's fairly safe to say by the end of the century, and some people think it'll be much more quick than that, we'll have machines that can write the great American novel, that can teach high school, whatever. And at that point, you ask those machines to design their successors, which they can do. And pretty soon you have one machine that's smarter than all humans. Well, okay, this happens very quickly once you get technology going. So I think that what that means is that most of the extraterrestrial intelligence, or maybe I should say alien intelligence, most of it is machines. It isn't biology.
Wow, you're certainly making us think tonight, Seth. That's for sure. Is there an alien megastructure as we know it?
Well, probably there are. You know, any giant engineering, I mean, gosh darn it. You know, we've been around for 200,000 years as Homo sapiens. The Earth has been around for 4.5 billion years. The cosmos has been around for 13 billion years. So, you know, most of the stars out there have had a lot more time than we have. And presumably, if there are other societies, if there are other aliens, there are some that are billions of years more advanced than we are. So who's to say what they might build? One thing that's been suggested are, you know, these Dyson spheres, giant, if you will, not really spheres, but swarms of solar panels orbiting their sun to collect a lot of energy for whatever it is they're using energy for. And indeed, a couple of months ago, there's a star that has been discovered, KIC 8462852.
Tabby star.
Yeah, Tabby star. Yeah, it's much easier to say Tabby star than KIC 8462852. But that star, you know, has some peculiar behavior that some people say, you know what that is, Ralph? That's a alien megastructure. Well, maybe it is, but probably not.
Dr. Jason Wright is the Penn State student who is researching what he is said to be an alien megastructure. This is something that came down either at the end of summer or the early part of fall last year. What was the reaction from SETI?
Well, what we did, well, I happen to know Jason Wright a little bit, and I think he would be the first to say that this strange behavior of this star, and we might as well describe what that is, it's just that every couple of weeks, months, years, it gets a little bit dimmer. Well, not just a little bit. Sometimes it gets 20, 22% dimmer. That's an enormous dip in brightness for a star, right? Just to do that for a little bit of time and then get bright again. Stars don't do that unless, you know, there's something passing between you and the star. But it couldn't be a planet if it's dimming the star by 22%. I mean, even something Jupiter size would only dim it by 1%. So, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine something that's, you know, four times the diameter of Jupiter, which is what you need. That would be a star, not a planet. So it's very mysterious what's causing these little dips in brightness. And Jason Wright made the suggestion, well, indeed, maybe it is an alien megastructure that occasionally gets between us and the star. You know, but he would be, as I say, the first to say, but that's the last explanation you should consider, because history shows that whenever you find something new and puzzling, it always turns out to be nature, not aliens.
Lots of theories on this. We've heard a whole bunch of them in the past couple of months since this story broke. What are some of your theories on this, Seth?
Well, I, you know, none of these theories seems to, you know, hold up. The first thought is that there's a lot of dust in that star system, because a lot of star systems do have a lot of dust. But those that do, they kind of reveal the dust when you look at them with an infrared telescope. Infrared telescopes like WFIRST, that's an infrared telescope, excuse me, that we have in space. But KIC, or Tabby Star, has been looked at with an infrared telescope, and there's not very much infrared coming from it. So it doesn't look like it's just dust. The explanation that Tabby herself and her team suggested was that it was a bunch of cometary debris, little bits of rock that are in orbit around the star, and every now and again they get in the way. That could be. It's very hard to tell, because this star is far away. It's almost 1,500 light years away, and that's a long way to do a study.
Seth, is it possible that we're looking at all the wrong places?
Well, I guess by definition we've been looking in the wrong places, because we haven't found anything yet. But that isn't to say that they're not out there. All that means is we have to look in the right places. But I don't know that we're systematically looking in the wrong places, although, you know, we continue to look for biology, right? We continue to point our antennas in the directions of stars that we think might have planets sort of like the Earth, with oceans and atmospheres and all that sort of stuff. But if, you know, the bulk of the intelligence in the cosmos is machine intelligence, it doesn't care about a planet with oceans. What does it need that for? It'll just rust the equipment. It probably gets off the planet and goes someplace a little better. So maybe we ought to be looking there.
Do you think maybe we should be looking underground?
Well, you could look underground. I think we should be looking underground for things like, you know, I don't know, platinum and copper and stuff like that. That's for sure. But in terms of looking for aliens, I think it's kind of tough to be an alien underground, because, you know, you don't have a whole lot of mobility. And beyond that, you know, you don't have to go down very far before the temperatures start getting really toasty. Mm-hmm. And eventually they get to the melting point of rock. And, you know, I think it's hard to be an alien in an environment where you're completely closed in and the temperatures are the melting point of rock.
I only say that because I can't describe, or I can't really explain, all of these strange underground sounds. They seem like, you know, big industrial construction projects, you know, well, the trumpet sounds. And to me, you know, when there's no explanation from science as to what's causing these sounds, literally in all parts of the world, several thousands of miles apart from me, I was thinking, well, you know, maybe when we're looking up, they're going below.
Well, I'm not familiar with these sounds, so you probably ought to tell me about them. Certainly, seismologists use sound to investigate, you know, the structure of the Earth. I mean, we can't dig down to the center of the Earth and see what's down there.
That was a cell phone.
It's not well. Not whales, huh? So it's...
Now, see, those are the trumpet sounds. Those are very indicative of what people have heard. But there's also been... I'm going to see if I can find one of those at the ready here, but... of industrial-like construction sounds. And if there was a big, if there was something like fracking going on or something to that extreme that was causing those sounds, somebody would be saying something about it. Would they not be, Seth?
Oh, I'm sure they would, because, again, you know, geologists, seismologists who study the inside of the Earth, the way they do that is they set off a small charge of explosive somewhere, and then they have detectors that pick up, you know, the sound after it's either, you know, traverse the Earth, it's gone from one side to the other, or more commonly, after it bounces off some layer below. And by studying that, they can say, okay, the, you know, it's a liquid rock down to this depth, and then there's an iron core, and there's whatever. You know, they can investigate what's underground, and that means that they have equipment that is sensitive to these acoustic waves. So if they were forever picking up, you know, the sounds of a job site for aliens, I think they would have said something about that.
Yeah, there's not only the trumpet sounds, but there's been reports of weird booms and explosions and rumbling, in fact, even over the Southwest. Just a theory I'm passing off on Seth Shostak, a really smart guy from the SETI Institute, senior astronomer there. Website is SETI.org, S-E-T-I.org. It's SETI Institute on Facebook and at SETI on Twitter. And, of course, you can find Seth Shostak on Twitter at Seth Shostak and look for him on Facebook as well. Seth, I'm interested, you had said earlier no signal of ET intelligence in all the years that he's been doing this, right?
That's correct. Yep.
Why do you believe that is? Do you believe that they're not out there to be found, or are you looking in places where they're not going to be found at that particular point in time, and maybe later they are, hence this report of these 20,000 star systems that at one point weren't identified as even possible targets, but are now back on the drawing board.
Well, yeah. I mean, some people do draw conclusions from the fact that SETI, I mean, some people have been doing SETI since 1960. It's been very intermittent. The first experiment was in 1960, and Frank Drake, who did that experiment, looked at two stars, two, count them, two. All right. And since that time, the total number that have been looked at is, you know, a few thousand, something like that. And I think that that's the answer to your question. We've only looked at a few thousand star systems. You know, it's the galaxy's big. The galaxy has, what, a couple of hundred billion stars. We've looked at a few thousand stars. So we've looked at 1/1,000,000th of the galaxy's stellar components, if you will. So it doesn't surprise me we haven't found anything yet. And you might say, well, okay, at the rate you're going, you know, it's going to be 16 lifetimes before you trip across a signal. Well, I mean, maybe that's true, but I don't think that's true because the speed of the search keeps increasing because the technology gets better. So we couldn't have done 20,000 stars a few years ago. Now we can, thanks to, you know, computers, really. So
what you're really saying, Seth, is over the next 2 years, you're going to look at more stars that have the possibility of holding the clues than has ever been looked at to this date.
That's correct. That's correct. Now, I have to just, you know, temper that slightly because there have been some surveys that have looked at the whole sky, but not over very much of the radio dial, not with terribly much sensitivity. So this is the first time that, you know, the number of targets, if you will, the number of places where we're just going to put our ear to and see if we hear anything is really it's 10 times, 20 times more than all the others put together. So, yeah, it's a step forward.
Are you using the Allen telescopes?
We are. We're using the Allen Telescope Array up in the Cascade Mountains here in California.
And primarily, explain how that system works.
Well, you know, anybody can go visit it, by the way. I should point that out.
Okay.
So you don't have to take me at my word here. But the array consists of 42 antennas. The idea is to build a lot more, but, you know, it's all privately funded, so there's no money yet to build a lot more. But it's 42 antennas, and each of the antennas is relatively small as these things go. They're about 20 feet in diameter. But they all work together as a team, and so you point them all in the same direction, and then we can combine what's coming out of these 42 antennas in such a way that we're actually sensitive to a couple of spots on the sky. It's like having a three-pixel camera, actually, which doesn't sound very impressive, but 3 pixels is a good idea for SETI because it allows us to compare 1 pixel with the other. If we find a signal, we make sure that it's only coming from 1 pixel. If it's coming from several, we can say that's interference, that sort of thing. Those are all technical considerations, but that's the antenna we use, or the array of antennas we use.
What is on the horizon for SETI?
Well, there are a lot of things. To begin with, a Russian investor by the name of Yuri Milner gave $100 billion to the $100 million dollars, slight difference there, but $100 million to the SETI group over at the University of California at Berkeley across the bay here. So that's allowing them to build all sorts of new equipment and rent time on big antennas. They're going to look at a lot of stars eventually, that's for sure. Well, that's good. I mean, you know, we would have preferred that some of that money came here, obviously. But looking at it from the big picture, it's only encouraging that somebody is promoting the search, because NASA's not funding this. The taxpayers aren't funding this. The entire world has maybe 12 people doing this. The Europeans aren't really doing anything. The folks in Japan and China say they're going to do it, but they haven't done it yet. So it's a, you know, it's been a back burner shoestring operation for a long time. And if you really want to find ET, you know, you got to put in some money. You know, people look for microbes on Mars. They spend billions of dollars to send hardware to Mars. This is worth some money, too. But at the moment, there isn't much.
Seth, best to you. I really appreciate you being on the program tonight. I know you've got an early morning. You've got to get out to the Contact Conference and then on to even another one after that in Colorado. Safe travels to you, and I look forward to doing another show with you down the line.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
So are you convinced? Is SETI doing everything that they possibly can to search for extraterrestrial intelligence? Should they have put their telescope out for more than two nights looking for this signal that was detected by the Russians? Should they be looking in different places, using different equipment? When we come back, it's a man who is still living the legacy of the late Dr. Edgar Mitchell, keeping his work alive. Dr. Mitchell founded the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters. Free has done a massive study about that, in which we'll have an upcoming program about. But late last year, the sixth man on the moon and the Apollo 14 astronaut lost his life. And we'll relive it with Ray Hernandez coming up on Into the Paranormal. I'm Jeremy Scott.
Major sighting here.
All over the place.
Holy.
Abnormal.
I see dead people walking around like regular people.
Paranormal. Somewhere between abnormal and paranormal.
I felt like something was near me, kind of a eerie feeling.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
Jeremy Scott asks the questions that we're all dying to know.
You can't handle the truth!
Hello? Hello?
You can't keep him down, no matter how hard you try.
Hey, that's the guy!
Traveling into the witching hour from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, you're riding into the paranormal.
Hey, if you've listened to me for any amount of time, you know that I do have a belief in artificial intelligence, that I think it is actually a pretty significant threat, that there are these robots that are doing all of the tasks that you and I, the human beings on this earth, have been doing for an awful long time. The programmers are getting better, and these things are able to do stuff that you wouldn't even think imaginable. And now they've put robots behind the wheel. That may sound a little dangerous to you, and I agree. It is a recipe for disaster, because if that programmer is off by just a millisecond, could be responsible for the loss of life. But there's two interesting stories as it relates to self-driving vehicles that I think we need to cover here before we get to Ray Hernandez. In Singapore, the world's first self-driving taxis have hit the road. And then we have a Chinese search engine and a chip maker announcing a partnership to use artificial intelligence to develop a computing platform for self-driving cars. Would you get in a self-driving vehicle, whether a taxi cab or a personal vehicle, if your friend said, hey, I'm going to come pick you up, and there's no one behind the wheel? Would you trust the programmer enough to get in? I would think it would be kind of cool, but I would still be a little bit reluctant. Nonetheless, it is proof that artificial intelligence is getting better. It's not too long before we humans are going to have to find something that we can do that they can't. Because once robots are able to do our jobs better, without complaint, with no sick days, the sooner it will happen. As we heard from Seth Shostak from SETI, if there's a promising signal, they will investigate. We know Seth is fascinated with the subject of extraterrestrial life. And we could go round and round and round again about why they haven't found any evidence. Well, tonight, you're going to hear evidence told by Ray Hernandez. He's with the group FREE, the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters. That was founded by the late Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who lost his life late last year. And Ray was actually with him in his final days. So he has some very unique insight on the life of the Apollo 14 astronaut and the sixth man on the moon that you're probably not going to hear anywhere else.
Ray, thank you for taking the time considering the circumstances.
Thank you. Thank you.
When did you learn of Dr. Mitchell's passing?
I learned about it this morning when I received communication from another dear friend of Edgar's who informed me that he passed away late last night at a hospice location in Broward County.
Mm-hmm. Was it unexpected, Ray?
No, it was expected. I visited him approximately 10 days ago or approximately 14 days ago at a hospital that he was staying at in Broward, and he was in very, very bad shape. And many of us knew that he didn't have too many days left.
Do you mind sharing maybe what some of the final words you had with Dr. Mitchell?
I spent about an hour with him at the hospital. I spoke about near-death experiences because I know that Edgar was also very much interested in near-death experiences. He also was one of the founders of Eternia, which is an organization that focused on near-death experiences, together with Dr. Eben Alexander. And so we mentioned that, and he says that, I mentioned that we are eternal spirits. And he says, yes, I know, Ray. And we talked a little bit about near-death experiences and about a series of NDEs that I had myself. And we spoke about the pursuit of consciousness, the topic of consciousness and the quantum hologram and the relationship of the various modalities of contact, where individuals are, quote-unquote, piercing the veil and having contact with non-human intelligent beings. And then I put Dr. Rudy Shields on the line. I called Rudy from there, from the bed, and he had a very, very brief conversation about with Rudy. And Rudy himself right now is in critical condition. He's had a couple of brain surgeries as well after our conversation. So... I held his hand for about an hour. He was holding it very tightly. He was unable to move much of his body at all. At the end, I asked him whether I could come back and visit him again. And he said, yes, Ray, please do. I always look forward to our visits. And then I kissed him on his forehead and I said my goodbyes to him.
Ray, it sounds like he still had that wit, that he had everything going on still upstairs, that he was still at the top of his game even 10 days before his death.
He was very coherent. I wouldn't say that it was the same Edgar Mitchell that I met several years ago, because he did have a sharp decline in his health over the last, at least the last year. But he still was witty. He was able to chat with Rudy. Rudy was telling him about his latest physics paper that he's writing. Rudy's actually is developing a paper on the actual physics of consciousness, hardcore physics, and how his work on black holes relate to that. How the black holes might be a depository of information, such as the Akashic records. And so they were talking some heavy-duty stuff, and Edgar was responding that, yes, Rudy, I'm in agreement with it, I'm in accord. So it wasn't very elaborative responses, but just, telling Rudy that he understands and he accepts what Rudy's saying. And our conversations as well were not extensive, conversations. It was very short and cryptic conversations back and forth with each other. But he was in very, very bad shape.
It depends on who you ask. Some will notice the name just because of Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Others, it'll ring a bell, and they're not quite sure. And you tell them the sixth person to walk on the moon, and the light bulb goes on. Many people didn't really understand Edgar, although he was a pioneer in many fields. He was probably known as the modern Leonardo da Vinci, as you say, in so many fields, a true pioneer for humanity to evolve in a higher plane of evolution.
Yes. My goodness. The vast majority of humanity, even people that are in this field of space travel or ufology, whatever you might want to call it, really understand the breadth of what Edgar's involvement has been. He was one of the leading modern founders of ESP research. He actually in space conducted some of J.B. Ryan's experiments. This is a professor at Duke University while he was in space. And some people know that information, but then when he returned, he began to reach the topic of ESP and telepathy almost as a full-time profession, and that led to the remote viewing and the telepathic work that the Stanford Research Institute got involved with, and that was a result of Edgar. Edgar brought that topic to these two physicists at Stanford, and then they eventually got some funding to begin doing basic work, parapsychology work on ESP, telepathy, and actually began remote viewing with the assistance first of that Israeli goodness, my name just skips the top of my head. The person that's known for bending spoons, Uri Geller.
Yes, Uri.
And then later on with Ingo Swann. And Edgar told me a couple of stories of Uri Geller that a lot of people don't know about. And that was within the presence of Uri Geller, various objects that he had lost several years prior to. One was one of those spoons that you wrap around a tea bag with, and other small objects like that just reappeared in Edgar's pocket, shirt pocket. And he was telling me, you know, some of these stories regarding Uri Geller that a lot of people just don't know about. And he had special abilities, and they were all tested and verified scientifically in a Faraday cage. The other thing is that Edgar then later on, within a few years later, from his work at Stanford, he founded the Institute for Noetic Studies. And that is pretty much the major institute around the world focusing on the topics of consciousness, on new energy, energy healing, and it's a huge complex now in Petaluma, California. And the most famous individual associated with them now is Dean Radin, Dr. Dean Radin, who has been their lead scientist for close to over 20 years. They have numerous employees, numerous PhDs associated with the Institute for Noetic Sciences. And also there they began doing actual studies, scientific studies on energy healing, and not just on the topic of ESP and parapsychology. Also, a lot of people don't know is that Edgar had been working with various physicists. He had formed this group called Quantrac. And it was mainly PhD physicists, and they were exploring the actual physics of energy healing, how it might work, the physics of zero-point energy fields. And he had been working very closely with Dr. Bernard Heisch on that topic, and Dr. Heisch published many years ago various articles on zero-point energy fields. And then later on, Edgar began publishing a series of documents, some of them for the layperson and some of them for physicists on the physics of consciousness and the quantum hologram. And again, this is, you know, heavy duty physics mixed in with a little bit of mystical aspects. He was very well read in the field of mysticism, of ESP, the Vedic texts. Because he had a somatic experience out in space that some people also know about, which totally transformed his view of our reality. And he also published in 1974 a state-of-the-art book on consciousness and parapsychology. And there it talked about out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences. It talked about remote viewing, ESP, precognition, all of these topic areas. And it had the major scholars at that time And it was a very, very thick book. And Edgar was the editor-in-chief of that. That was in way back in 1974. And also a lot of people know Edgar about the pioneering work that he did with the disclosure movement. It was actually Edgar that brought all of the military folks to Stephen Greer. Without Edgar being there, all of that work would have been for nil, because Edgar was the one that opened the doors to government operatives and government folks and military folks throughout the world, and he has been primarily the main astronaut that has continued to publicly talk about the fact that yes, UFOs exist, and yet ETs exist. And we're being visited, and individuals are having encounters with these non-human intelligent beings. And to his deathbed, he was there talking and giving speeches about all of these phenomena. Also, a lot of people don't know Edgar's relationship with the near-death experience movement. Right from the very beginning, he had been heavily involved with the NDE movement. He was a very close friend with John Audette, who was the founder of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. This is the organization that was co-founded by Dr. Raymond Moody. So Edgar was involved in that from the very beginning. He was very close colleagues with the Ryan Institute, the professors at the Ryan Institute, with the Princeton peer review department, with the University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies, with Dr. Ian Stevenson, whose work on reincarnation, and Bruce Grayson, who's the world's leading academic on NDEs and on out-of-body experiences also, with Dr. Kenneth Ring, who again was a top academic that had researched the NDE phenomenon. So he was one of the key people as well behind the scenes with the near-death experience movement. And also he was very prominently out there talking against the weaponization of space. He knew about Wernher von Braun's statements that saying that they're going to be using the threat of ET attacks on our society to speed up the weaponization of space. He publicly talked about the block op types of discussions in government to try to portray, you know, this UFOs in a very negative light, that it might be a threat to society in order to be able to weaponize space. He also has made several videos on the topic of sustainability and sustainable growth. And he was very out in the open that if humanity continues at the rate of growth that we're having, that we will destroy ourselves. He also talked about that that humans are basically one step above, you know, barbarians, because the way we treat each other, the way we fight all the wars, how we just can't get along, how we have all these divisions in humanity. I mean, I could go on and on and on. One statement that he has repeated over and over again was that that humanity must establish relationship with these ETs, he calls them. But I know he meant non-human intelligent beings, because he always said we don't know what they are. He said we must establish relationship with these ETs just like we need to establish relationships with our next-door neighbors. And he says that in the future we also might need them, because we might be at the point of blowing up our Earth and making it totally unsustainable for growth. So we might actually need their help in leaving Earth. So he said that numerous times. So when you add up all these different things that Edgar has worked on all his life, you can truly see that he's the modern Leonardo da Vinci to try to change humanity to go down a different path, a more sustainable, loving, and open path. He's someone that has been working on the actual hardcore physics of the true nature of our reality, and he's been out there on the open publicly telling the world that our reality is not what we think it is, that it's filled with life, our whole universe is filled with life, and that we need to wake up and smell the coffee. And so that's just a very brief overall summary of just how beloved and powerful Dr. Edgar Mitchell's life was. And Dr. Rudy Shields, who's the executive director of our organization, FREE, Rudy has always stated that Edgar deserves the Nobel Prize for Humanity.
What a fantastic tribute, Ray. Really do appreciate it. And tell us about the organization, because you're the operations manager there, and I know that I know the rest of the gang is going to be so much more committed to finishing what he started as the co-founder of FREE, the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters.
It's an organization that was co-founded by Dr. Edgar Mitchell, by Dr. Rudy Shields, who's a 75-year-old emeritus professor of astrophysics at Harvard University and a very close colleague of Dr. John Mack, and also Mary Rodwell, who's a researcher in Australia, and myself. And our organization is comprised of roughly half. Half of them are retired professors, academic professors, and the other half are individuals that have been working in the field of consciousness, the paranormal, and ET contact. And what we're doing is we're our approach is that all of the various contact modalities, like I explained earlier, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, mystical meditation, ET contact, shamanic experiences, channeling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the way humans are piercing the veil and having contact with non-human intelligent beings, that instead of being separate and distinct operations, that in fact they are all interrelated, and that they're all interrelated through what is commonly known as consciousness, and it's some type of advanced physics that we're still not fully grasping. But it's a topic that they're all interrelated. And what we're doing in FREE is we're trying to study the experiencers of all of these different contact modalities and to see what they have in common, the commonalities. And the first academic study that we've undertaken is the first ever academic study on the UFO-related contact phenomenon.
Wow.
And it's a five-phase study. We have just finished the first two phases in the two-and-a-half-year period. And so far, we've had 2,000 individuals participate in our both quantitative and qualitative our research studies. And some of the findings that we have will truly rock, you know, the field of contact. And so, you know, this is not just about ufology. This is much, much more profound than that. And so, therefore, our targeted audience is a very wide and diverse target audience. For example, some of the research that we found was that 60% of these individuals have had out-of-body experiences. 25% have had near-death experiences. Almost all of them have seen UFOs and have seen ETs. Numerous of other topic areas that people suspected, but they had no idea. Like, for example, only 5% have stated their experiences to be very negative. Another 15% have stated their experiences were somewhat negative. Another 15%, it was neutral, but the vast majority were positive experiences. We asked them, if you could stop your contact experiences, would you? And 85% of them said no. 40% of these individuals have had an ET performed a healing, a medical healing, on either themselves or a member of their families.
The world has lost a great man in Dr. Edgar Mitchell, but the work lives on through FREE. You'll find them at experiencer.org. It is Labor Day weekend. When we come back, more with Ray Hernandez on his experiences from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Midwest of the United States. I'm Jeremy Scott. Next week on the program, Don Phillips is here from across the pond. We're going to be talking about investigating the paranormal. Don's been here before with the Washington State Poltergeist House gang, but he's here by himself because his experiences are unlike many others. And his way of going about investigating the paranormal is absolutely genuine. Week after that, it's Dr. Jim Roach talking spiritual near-death experiences. Real-life stories of patients who have had NDEs. On the 24th, Bill Bean joins me to talk about possession and exorcisms. We're back, though, with Ray Hernandez of Free at Experiencer.org, who himself has had a life of the extraordinary.
I went to the University of California, Berkeley, for a PhD in city and regional planning. And as many individuals know, University of California, Berkeley is the university that has the most Nobel Prize winners in the world. And previous to that, I attended Cornell University for a master's in urban planning. And I was writing my dissertation for my PhD when my ex-wife had a brain aneurysm, which forced me to give up my dissertation and take two full-time jobs because I had two little babies to feed and
my God.
A wife that was very, very sick. So if it wasn't for that event, I would be now pretty much very close to retirement from a major academic institution.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm currently an estate tax attorney with the IRS, and that's an inheritance tax. And so I won't be dealing with any of your listeners unless they die with more than $5 million worth of net assets. So basically, I have an academic mindset, an intellectual academic mindset, and I had never been exposed to anything in the paranormal realm, UFOs, ETs, aliens, never bothered to pay attention to any of this. And then I myself and my wife and my daughter then began having a series of experiences. The first one started in March of 2012, where we had an energy being that appeared in our living room that my wife was praying all night for some type of a miracle, some type of angelic intervention. She was a hardcore Catholic. Our dog the night before became totally paralyzed, and we were going to be euthanizing her that next day. So my wife was praying all night, and then the next morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, the dog started barking. We checked her out. She was still totally paralyzed. So then I went back to sleep, and my wife carried the dog down the stairs to see if she can go to the bathroom. That was going to be her last day on Earth. And then when she got downstairs to the living room, she had contact with this non-human intelligence in our living room. She then called me to come downstairs to see it. And then when I got downstairs, she was ahead of me. She totally disappeared with the dog in front of my eyes. All of a sudden, mind control took place, and that's what a lot of people don't understand with direct contact with these intelligent beings, is that they're totally into your mind, manipulating your mind. And I basically, what I saw was a floating plasma being. It was rectangular in shape, roughly 2 to 3 feet wide by a foot and a half in height. Didn't have any external edges because it was pure energy, multicolored, semi-translucent, floating 4 feet off the ground and less than 10 feet away from me. And what I did was totally illogical, but this is, what took place. I looked at this thing. I then waved my hand at it, and I said, ah, BS. This is what she woke me up here for, this BS, you know? And then I turned around. I started walking upstairs. I went to bed, put my hands on my chest, and I was knocked out for 45 minutes. And then when I woke up, then I was cognizant of what took place. And I was like, holy, you know what, holy cow. And I ran down the stairs. And then right at the same exact spot where I was, my wife reappeared at the same exact spot and started celebrating in the middle of the living room. The angels cured her, the angels cured her, the angels cured her, hallelujah, the angels cured her. Like she was in some type of Pentecostal church, you know. And then the dog was running around, jumping up and down and running and running. And in my head, it was like an atom bomb exploded in my head, And then my wife's story did not match my story. And the reason was because later on, like 6 months later, I learned this concept called missing time. From my wife's perspective, she went downstairs with me right behind her. She then looked down. The dog started running around. And she said, oh, she's cured, you know, and she started celebrating. But she has no idea at all about the 45 minutes of the missing time. So that was our first experience. And then after that, over the next 6 months, my wife, not myself, began having numerous types of sightings of UFOs. She went down to Mexico to stay with her family in Mexico, and there she had four different contact experiences, two times with these entities that look human. They were very tall, dressed in white monk's robes, and then other types of close UFO sightings. Two of these events were witnessed by her family members. One event had eight members that witnessed this. And then I began having these very close contact experiences. And then after that, it was just an explosion of experiences to the point where I thought I was going crazy.
This was a transformative situation for Ray when he began to have his near-death experiences, was it not, Ray?
Oh, completely transformative. And towards the end of the show, Bob can reel off some of the data of specific questions that we asked and responses on this transformation. That was our number one finding, I think, by all of our members of our committee, just how these series of experiences totally transforms the experiencer for the positive.
Your personal experience... Yes. Oh, were you going to say something?
What I was going to say is what I wanted to introduce to you, to your listeners, is a summary of Phase 1. And there we go over the specific types of ETs and how people responded for the specific ETs. So it's actually getting that earlier statement of the positive or negative aspects mm-hmm. of it and then focusing on the specific types of ETs.
Please.
And how, yeah. All right. Let me ask, we asked this question. Have you seen an intelligently controlled craft in the sky or on the ground that was not man-made? In other words, have you seen a UFO? Okay. Well, we had almost 1,600 people. 78% of our respondents said that they have seen a UFO. Okay. We also asked them, were there any other witnesses? Well, 999 had witnesses, which is 64.5%. So if you see a UFO, in all likelihood, you're going to have a witness to it. Missing time, we had 1,062 people that have experienced missing time. Extra time, such as arriving much sooner than expected, for which you cannot find any reasonable explanation. Well, we had 655 people that have experienced that. Telepathic messages, an external voice in your head speaking to you, okay? We had 1,280 people that have had telepathic messages. Here's an interesting question, and Grant Cameron was fascinated by this response. Do you believe that you possess information about advanced technology, advanced physics, or other scientific information that you've never read or learned in your normal environment? Well, we had 799 people said yes, and including myself in that case. There's a whole lot of rumors going around about Rh negative, that the people that are being abducted, people that are being contacted, it's all Rh negative. Well, mm-hmm. we determined that that's false. Rh negative is only 14.6% of the individuals that answered this survey, and the standard percentages for Rh negative in the U.S. population is 15%. So you see, Jeremy, how we're getting these stereotypes and we're putting these things to the test. We had 742 people that they believe that they have an implant in their body. But out of those 742, only 108 have ever had that implant detected by either an X-ray or MRI or some other type of device. This is another fascinating question. Have you ever experienced an out-of-body experience? Okay. Excuse me. 1,520 people. 80% of the people that responded had an out-of-body experience. Now, that's something that ufology doesn't talk about. Okay? Let me also ask another question that, again, very, very striking. Near-death experiences. We asked them, have you ever had a near-death experience? Well, 36%. A huge number have had near-death experiences, okay? We asked them, how many of you have actually physically seen a non-human intelligent being? 1,088 people. So you see where I'm getting at, Jeremy? This is not a study of 20, 30, 50 people. 1,088 people have had direct physical contact with an ET. Now, let's go over the different types of beings, okay? Mm-hmm. If you would go, was it routinely being perceived by the internet as the number one type of being, you would say the short grays.
Okay? I'm going to say praying mantis.
Praying mantis, nuh-uh. Let me go over the actual numbers, okay? The number one type of being seen by individuals is the energy being. 55.4%, okay? Number two is the human-looking being at 53.3%. Then we get into the short grays at 50.5%. And then the tall grays was 32. The hybrids was 27. The praying mantis types insectoid was 22.6%. The reptilian was 25.5%. And then we had the small animal type at 14% and the large animal type at 13%. So the number one being, the energy being, was seen by 577 people. And the human-looking type of being was seen by 555 people. Okay, so those are the number one type of being. Now, we also asked them a question, did you also interact with this being? Well, 72% said yes, they interacted with this being. It's not just you looking at them, you're actually interacting with them. Now, how many times did you interact with these beings? The vast majority is 20 or more times. 20 or more times was almost 39.5%. Between 11 and 20 was 6.6. Between 8 and 10 times was 8%. Between 5 and 7 was 9.4. So you get the gist. If you're going to see these beings, you're going to be seeing it more than once. And then let me get into the specifics of each type of being, okay? And I'm just going to give you the negative, how these people view these as negative, okay? The short grays, okay? Only 11.6% view their experiences with the short grays as negative, okay? The vast majority of them, over 60% viewed them as neutral, okay? Positive was 28%. Okay? So, again, this is not the stereotype that's out there on the internet. And it was 704 people that answered this question. So it's a huge number. Okay? The tall grays. Mainly negative was 10.5%. Mainly positive was almost 32%. So, again, almost 3-1. Individuals seeing the tall grays is more positive than negative. The rest was neutral. The hybrid, mainly positive, was 47%. Mainly negative was 6.5%. The insectoid, what you talked before, the praying mantis types, mainly positive was 32.5%. Mainly negative was 9.2%. The evil dreaded reptilians. Okay, how many people, percentages, would you say that viewed their experiences with these reptilians as mainly negative? What would you guess at, Jeremy?
So the total percentage of reptilian encounters is what, 25%?
I think it was like 22%.
Yeah, gotcha.
24%. I don't know the exact number.
So,
I'll have to go back. But out of the people that saw these reptilians, how many would you guess viewed them as mainly negative?
I'm going to go 60%.
Okay. The correct answer is 22.6%.
Way off.
Me tell you how many people answered this question. 384 people had encounters with reptilians. Okay? We're not talking about 10, 20 people here. 384 people, and it's 22.66%, almost 23% said mainly negative. Mainly positive was 17.7%. Equally positive and negative was 12.7%. Neutral was 16.4%. And I'm not sure was 30.5%. So basically, almost 18% viewed them as positive. 23% viewed them as negative. And the rest of the people, mainly neutral type of experiences. And again, that's not what's circulating in the internet. Now, the human-looking being, as I said, was the number two type of being, overwhelmingly positive. That's 61%. Mainly negative was only 5.6%. and the rest was neutral type of experiences. And then the spirit form or the ghost-like type of form, it was 45.5% was positive, mainly negative was 6.6%. So this, and then we have the small animal type and the large animal type. Again, 38% positive, 5% negative. So as you can see, Jeremy, this type of information is not what's circulating on the internet. Even when we broke it down by the different types of entity, okay, it still came out as mainly positive, as a very, very small percent. Most of these experiences for the mantids, for the tall and the short grays, were mainly neutral type of experiences. For the other type of entities, then it was, you know, very positive, like the human type of entity, the energy being, or the ghost and spirit type of being. Then it was very, very positive.
About 450 individuals say they had conscious memories of being on board a craft. Can you give us a little bit more background there? What do they report this craft to be?
We asked various questions about their experiences aboard a craft, and many, many people, as you said, 300 and now it's almost 400 people have stated that they have had experiences aboard a craft. It's a very large number. And out of those people, we asked them questions of how they got to the craft, and some of the people were dematerialized and rematerialized aboard a craft. Some people actually walked to a craft, but the vast majority of people have no idea how they got to a craft. They just appeared in the craft. We also asked them questions of what took place aboard the craft, and a good many of them were did have a little medical checkup, for lack of a better word. They know that they were put under the table and they were examined. In terms of also many people were allowed to walk around the craft, some accompanied, some by themselves. The vast majority of entities that they saw on the craft were human-looking beings, and the short grays and the tall grays. Also, some people were allowed to walk in the craft by themselves. Some people, we asked them questions of what do they think, do they know what operates the craft, and about 20% of them said yes. Many of them said that the craft is actually a living being, that if you touch the craft, you get downloaded information like a living being. So it's a whole vast array of questions we asked them to answer that question. If I could sort of transition to a topic that we haven't discussed before.
Please.
And I think it's a very, very important, and it deals with also, you know, experiences in the craft. That is, we ask these individuals, and let me ask you the same, the actual question. Do you believe that any of these ETs have performed a medical healing on either you or another member of your family? Well, 50% said yes. Okay?
What do we mean?
483 people said yes. A huge number said that they have had a medical healing. And there was a book that was written 20 years ago by Preston Dennett, where he categorized 220 cases of medical healings by these entities. I have two close friends that are out in the open that have publicly discussed these medical healings. One is Chris Bledsoe, who was on disability. He was collecting a disability check for Crohn's disease. And he was taken for 7 hours. And when he was returned, he was completely cured of Crohn's disease. And he and five other adult witnesses saw all these ETs and all the UFO crafts. It was fully documented, reported to MUFON. And the other one is Reverend Michael Carter, who's an ordained minister. He has a master's from the New York Theological Seminary. He even has his own congregation. And he was cured by these human-looking beings of a leg that had a blood clot, and it was twice the size of the other leg. And he says this tall, very tall human-looking being appeared all suddenly in front of him, touched him, knocked him out, and when he woke up, his leg was the normal size as the other leg. So these are experiences, again, that the typical UFO field, the internet, does not discuss, and it's a hidden secret. And as I told you here, we have 483 people have stated that they have been healed by these ETs. The other item that I want to talk about, and hopefully we can close the show with this, is to go over the summary of how people have changed. And this we found to be the number one aspect of our research study. And if I could go over some of them, some of these questions and answers with you.
Absolutely.
Briefly.
Yeah, and so okay. This is the statistic that says 85% have undergone major transformations for the positive, correct?
Correct. And let me just ask you tell you the exact questions, and I'll tell you the strongly increased or the increased somewhat, okay? We asked the question, my desire to help others, okay? My compassion for others, my appreciation of the ordinary things of life, my ability to listen patiently to others. Now, the opposite is this question, my concern for material things in life is the total opposite. Now, all of a sudden, people don't care about material things, okay? Strongly decreased is the primary answer here with material items. My tolerance for others, strongly increased. My sensitivity to the sufferings of others, strongly increased. My concern with spiritual matters, strongly increased. My interest in organized religions, the total opposite, strongly decreased. So people are not care about any more about religion, but they're become deeply spiritual now. Questions, my understanding of myself, as Bob said earlier, strongly decreased. Okay, my desire to achieve a higher consciousness, strongly increased. My appreciation of nature, we asked these ecological and nature questions, about four of these, and for all of these questions, strongly increased. All of a sudden, people that couldn't give a damn about, you know, the ecology and nature, all of a sudden, you know, are tree huggers, you know, strongly increased their appreciation of nature, to protect nature. My competitive tendencies, total opposite, strongly decreased. So all of a sudden, you know, they don't have that competitiveness with other individuals. My spiritual feelings have strongly increased. My religious feelings strongly decreased. My concern for the welfare of the planet, Earth, has, again, strongly increased. And I could go on and on. We asked like 40 more of these questions. But that'll give you an understanding of how these people have been transformed. It's like a total and complete transformation of their psychological profile, and which can be characterized as positive. And that, to us, is the number one finding from our research study.
What a story from Ray. We'll have to have an entire program with him and Dr. Bob Davis as well from Free to outline their experiencer study. It's pretty groundbreaking, riveting stuff that we'll have in a future show. Until next week, from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon, somewhere deep in the remote Midwest of the United States, back in Oregon next week when I talk to you. Enjoy your Labor Day weekend. Good evening.